Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues and how they move from being unthinkable to plausible to policy and talk to the people who change what is possible in politics. Nevada senators recently voted against new film subsidy, an idea that has seemed irresistible to other lawmakers around the country. And to talk about that, I'm joined by Michael Brown, the former head of Nevada's Office of Economic Development and fellow at the Lindsay Institute at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and retired head of Barrick Gold U.S. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why were legislators in Nevada looking at film credits?
This idea percolated up in 21 when I was director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development, right as we were coming out of the pandemic into the ARPA rescue phase. And it kicked around Nevada politics for several years, but there were a couple film studios that were persistent at it, and they partnered with a local real estate development company, Howard Hughes, and came forward with this proposal. I spent about 3 years looking at this off and on, both in a government capacity, and then when I got the Lindsay Institute, I produced a paper with the help of your organization.
Thank you for that shout out. Yeah, it's been an issue that we've been talking about here in Michigan. Yep. We had film subsidies for a while. We got rid of them. Lawmakers have been trying to push it back, and it's been kind of stuck in that conversation of whether they should exist or shouldn't exist. So let's...
Nevada had a small program. I called it a boutique program. It was supposed to kind of support the local creative arts community. But this became a mega $1.8 billion proposal that was being put forward. Legislature had rejected it in 23. They couldn't get the votes together early in 25. And then it was brought forward in a special session earlier this week.
Okay, so this has been a conversation that's going for a long time, but I wanted to go back to a thing that you said, which is that this was a proposal that some people in the industry, in both the real estate and the film industries, had kind of put together and pitched to lawmakers. And one of the things I think people don't realize is that legislators are usually responding to ideas that are being pitched to them. Sometimes they come up with their own ideas, but often it's just someone has an idea to pitch, they find some sympathetic legislators, and maybe they get the support for it. So,
There were two things I learned about this. One is that there's a whole role of film financiers that sit between the studios and the political process that are out there, I think, trying to kind of create more buckets of money, frankly, to help finance movies. People have a 1950s view of how movies are actually made, you know, and, you know, when you watch the credits and you see all the LLCs that kind of, you know, all those people are capital invested in making that film. The second is that typically they bypass the Economic Development Office and go straight into the political process. When I was economic development director, I was appointed and I went and met with my colleagues and I said, well, what are you guys doing on film? And they were like universally, oh, no, that doesn't work. It doesn't work.
That's interesting because the film subsidies that are being pitched are always pitched as an economic development tool.
They are, but they rely on the culture of celebrity that we live in. And I think people's perception of how Hollywood actually works. And, you know, I've visited all the major studios in my life. I follow, you know, I'm a member of the Film Noir Society, as you can see in the background, maybe. You know, it is in the 90s, films got expensive. Hollywood needed new money to finance these movies. And, you know, Louisiana, as you well know, started it. And then it just became, you know, it just spread like wildfire of runaway productions. But you're basically taking a movie and giving it the same status as a public good, like the Highway Patrol or child nutrition programs.
Often more expensive than that, depending on the program that you got. Paying for 25 to 30% of film's production expenses in the state is an expensive proposition.
Well, and I was no stranger to Nevada politics. I'd been involved in everything since 1995. I'd been engaged as head of a large corporation here, and then as a political appointee. You know, in Nevada, we don't have an income tax, and our property tax system is rather weak. And so the state's finances are largely dependent on gaming and sales taxes, which is highly dependent on the volatility of tourism. And, you know, I remember when we first looked at this and my analytical staff came in and they said, this is going to cost $1 billion out of the general fund. It's like, we don't have $1 billion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting thing, too, that goes on behind the scenes that I think a lot of people don't know about, which is there are these proposals. There is a price tag associated with them. And we do have some trained professionals that are trying to give legislators, policymakers, economic development officials, you know, just some quality data on like what this program does.
Yeah, it took me a long time to understand transferable tax credits. I did not understand how
they worked. Me too, by the way.
They sounded like they paid for themselves. I spent the summer of 24 kind of moving around the state because I thought we had a large obligation of them because we had 7 other transferable tax credit programs, but I couldn't find what our outstanding obligation is. I still can't find it, frankly.
That's interesting because don't you have to have treasurers writing those tax credits and then submit them or someone by right?
The accounting standard is such that in the state's official finances under whatever governing authority it is, they only have to report what was redeemed in a given year. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered was we had 8 different programs run by 5 different agencies. And there's no consolidated report that says we've authorized this amount, we've granted this amount, and we've had this amount redeemed. And so every time they do the budget, they have to kind of make a sophisticated wild guess as to what's going to happen. And in this budget process, they were just about to close our budget. Our legislature only meets every other year for 120 days. And they were just about to close the budget. And as you know, that's when every penny counts, when you're closing a budget. And suddenly we lost $4 million to WrestleMania for a promotional film that had been done for WrestleMania that came right out of the general fund as they were closing the budget.
So I did want to get up to the transferable tax credits.
Yes,
because
yes,
it's a technical issue, but it's a really important one for people to realize, because the reason for transferability is that people think it sounds different.
Exactly.
So if you're running an economic development program, you can just write checks. Like, you can make grants to companies. You can just pay them, put it in the budget, spend money on film productions if you want. But what a lot of the film subsidy programs tend to be are tax credit programs, where they say we will reimburse you for 30, 35%, 25%, whatever they decide for how much you spend in the state of Nevada. We'll go through your books, and once you're finished filming, we'll give you a tax credit. And that tax, those companies that have the film that do this, though, tend not to have any tax liabilities at all.
Exactly.
Like, they're not subject to business tax. They didn't make any income on the actual film production side of things. There's a lot of corporate hats that are being shifted around for these production companies. And so they have a tax credit against the tax that they don't own. Normally, that would be worth nothing at all. However, states can make that tax credit refundable, which means that if they have a tax credit worth $10,000, they just get a $10,000 check from the government when they file their taxes for taxes that they don't owe. Or it can be transferable, mm-hmm. where they might have a $10,000 tax credit that they can't use, but another business in Nevada could use that. And so they sell it to them. The company winds up, they sell it at a discount. Maybe 85%, maybe 95% on the dollar. I guess it really depends on the market for tax credits in Nevada, which I'm unfamiliar with. But the bottom line is that that film production company now gets cash worth 85 cents on the dollar. And that other Nevada business, who was not involved in the filmmaking process at all, gets the privilege of not paying $10,000 in taxes. So
I wish I'd known you in May of 24, because that's the best explanation I think I've ever heard.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, I've been working at this for a while, too. Just to digress, one of the things that I do is I have a scorecard for how all lawmakers in Michigan since 2000 have voted on selective business subsidy issues. And our subsidy means, like the definition, we have to say, does it allow for the business to collect cash from taxpayers? Mm-hmm. And so refundable tax credits, absolutely included. Grant programs, absolutely included. And this transferable thing, like, does this count or not?
Yeah, this emerged when they created the first film tax program in 2011, 2013. And when I was looking at the minutes, I found this line in the minutes where it says, oh, yes, we use transferable tax credits to get around the constitutional provision of providing cash to companies.
Oh,
I mean, they were that direct. When I was economic development director, my governor was not a proponent of using a lot of tax incentives and abatements. Mm-hmm. And I didn't use a dollar of my discretionary authority in this area. Nevada's economic development is very different than Michigan's and Ohio. You know, you can kind of be all things to all folks. You know, we have infrastructure gaps. We have water challenges. So Nevada's advantage is to be an alternative to California for logistics and manufacturing. You know, we have close proximity.
No one could act
right here. Yeah. And there's no corporate income tax. And so I didn't like them. And then as I tried to understand them, I consulted with the Urban Institute. And the Urban Institute, the scholar there, he says, a state without an income tax should not be playing with transferable tax credits. You're just playing with fire.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Because they don't recover anything, particularly in film. I mean, it might recover in manufacturing if you've got a serious manufacturing concern. But with film, it's not an incentive. It's a permanent subsidy. Mm. You know, I calculated that our general fund would get about a dime back for every dollar we put out in film tax credits. And that was using the numbers provided by the advocates in their PowerPoint. Our GOAD looked at it. My successor looked at it. He produced a report and he said it would be 23 cents because we have a separate fund for education that sits outside the general fund. But it reconfirmed about a dime to our general fund. And then our Legislative Council Bureau, a legislator finally in the hearings asked the Legislative Council Bureau, what will this cost? And they affirmed all the numbers that we were going to be losing $150 to $200 million a year out of our general fund, which is just something we simply can't afford.
Mm-hmm. How big is the general fund in Nevada?
Oh, my gosh. I think it comes in. Sorry, I didn't know this would be a math quiz. I think it comes in around 5 or 6. But our budget is highly restricted where a lot of money is categorized in different things.
Yeah,
I had the economic development director of Utah tell me, he said, this former one, he says, Michael, you think not having income tax is an advantage. He says, we can offer all sorts of abatements and incentives on the corporate side, and it makes up for it with the personal income taxes, and that balances out. But, and I thought, okay, so that means my options are even more limited. But when it came to film, it was like, I'm going to get 2 dimes and 3 pennies back for every dollar we put out. In manufacturing, we'll get like $3.50 to $4 for everything we do in manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. So you bring up like the primary reason why people oppose film subsidies. They're expensive. Paying for 25 to 35% of a film's production's expenses costs taxpayers a lot of money. And on the other side, the proponents are like, but look at all the economic benefits.
Oh, yes. Let me talk about that. So, you know, I finally, you know, I did a corporate career. I did a political appointment. Now I'm in academia and doing research. And the Lindsay Institute's the public policy think tank associated with Brookings that sits here at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. So this is all of the think tank papers from across the country. So film tax credits are a bad idea. This is all of the peer-reviewed papers as to why film tax credits are a bad idea.
this.
To podcast listeners who are not watching this on YouTube,
yeah, okay.
He has three massive binders of academic work on the subject.
This is all of the state audits of film tax credits as to why they're a bad idea. And this little tiny book here is the research that said they were a good idea.
Yeah.
So I then consulted with J.C. Bradbury and with Button at Tulane and with Michael Tom at USC, who are kind of the three leading economists on all this. And
Michael Tom's written some stuff for us in the past. So
yeah, it's kind of fun because when you have EDU after your email, you can just kind of reach out to all these people. They reply. That's the reply.
You know, I got to tell you, as a nonprofit person, they reply to .orgs as well. Probably all those .coms. It's very rare that you get an academic who wants to talk where someone from the outside wants to talk about their research.
Yeah. And so they helped me understand that conventional economic analysis doesn't work because of the footloose nature. And that was a term that was coined by the Boston Federal Reserve Bank because it's film production is a stack of gigs, you know, one job after another. And because of the footloose nature, it does not produce the jobs, and the jobs in the runaway states that go to the locals tend to be catering, security. You know, it's not the creative arts, high-end jobs. The other thing that was happening, though, was, you know, people were looking to this. There were claims that this was a recession-proof industry, that we would get great stability. And I was like, I've been reading The Hollywood Reporter and Variety and Deadline and Indie News every single day for the last year. I mean, this is an industry in massive disruption. And so I tried to bring that information forward also to legislators so they understood.
So one of the things that I think is that I know from my experience of working in policy, which is you've got a situation where it's a question of costs and benefits.
Yes.
And when you look at it with clear eyes, it really seems like the costs exceed the benefits. I mean, theoretically, you can put a case where maybe some way they'll pay off, especially if the number on film subsidies are low and there's some promise for a sustainable industry without subsidies. It just doesn't happen in this area. But when legislators are viewing this, they're viewing it from a different frame, which is not what are the actual costs to the state government and the benefits to the state economy. They're looking at individual political costs and benefits. And one of the sad things that I've learned is that if a lawmaker wants to ignore the cost of a program, there's nothing you can do to convince them otherwise.
No. And my job in an academic role was to provide the facts. I produced a 25-page paper with 59 footnotes in it and, you know, probably 75 to 100 different references. And I had fiscal analysis. I also analyzed the job claims and put that out. But you're right. It's a political process. I'm not naive to that. I can't engage in that. You know, I'm a think tank within a university. However, what happened?
You are a person who has free speech rights. You work for an organization that does things that you can share your political views on things. Yes, lobbying is a regulated industry, but there's a lot that people can do if they want to speak out on these issues.
There is. And getting the information around, so like the work product that your organization put out was very helpful because it was the best explanation of transferable tax credits related to film that I was able to find. But what happened in Nevada, I'd never seen before. I've been involved here since 95, is on the progressives on the left and the conservatives on the right united on this issue, mm-hmm. and kind of like a horseshoe. And I think there's something called the horseshoe theory of politics. And they pushed back on this, and it divided organized labor between construction unions, public service unions. It divided
as in Democratic construction unions for film subsidies, public service unions against.
Yeah. And rightfully so. If I were them, I'd have done the same thing. You know, the alternative, though, would be to, you know, just have them work on public works projects, you know, take the $125-150 million and do public works projects.
Need to build a lot of water infrastructure.
Yeah. The public employees union came out on the other side. The teachers union split in two. the Democratic caucus in the assembly split in half between younger members and older members. And ultimately in the Senate,
younger members or older members pro subsidy? I couldn't tell.
Members were against this idea, and the older, more senior members, by seniority were for it. It really, I've never seen this before. In the final vote, that pattern that came out in our Senate has never been seen before. I don't know if it'll ever be seen again, because it was very bipartisan divide. They needed 11 votes to prevail, and they could only get to 10.
Mm-hmm. That's a razor close, a razor thin margin, as close as you can get.
Yes. Same in the assembly. It came out of the assembly by only one vote.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think there was cross ideological agreement on this issue?
And I guess, you know, because it's got, I assume that it was the case for both, like the, there were Republicans and Democrats who were for it, and there were Republicans and Democrats who were against it.
Yes, that's right. And geographically, you know, we're a very large state, but our population is concentrated, 70% in the Las Vegas area, 15% in, Reno, and then the rest spread across the vast rural population. You know, so there was a bit of a regional part to it, but I don't know. It's going to take some political scientists here to figure out exactly how this unfolded, because it was really unprecedented.
The mysteries of the science around the Overton window, I guess.
Yes, this is not something I know a lot about. So tell me more.
And well, on this one, I do on this issue of film subsidies, and in general of business subsidy issues, I think both people on the right and the left are somewhat skeptical, is like it is not very progressive to take money from everyone and give it to a couple of Hollywood producers. It's for free market conservatives, that's not how you're supposed to grow your economy either. That's agreement on both that this is a bad idea. But on the other side, there's the basics of politics, which is we want to show that we're doing something about jobs. That appeals to both Republicans and Democrats as well.
Yes.
And as you said, special interest groups, yes, there is a concentrated thing, film subsidies, and you said they're real estate developer who really, really want this. But you have your other conventional political interests too, and they're split on the issue as well, which made to a deadlock. And but I guess, and I again, I don't have an answer to this, why on this issue but not other ones? I think
I don't know. This is something that's going to have to be watched and examined. On my side, I was concerned about the fiscal impact of transferable tax credits in a state without an income tax. The professors and experts I talked to showed that it didn't produce the jobs in the states. Even the states where they insisted on building studios, you know, like Louisiana, New Mexico, it hadn't produced those results. And frankly, we also took a look at what was happening up in Michigan and how you all had embraced the program about the same time Nevada created its boutique program and then withdrew it. I guess there was an attempt in 24 to recreate it. And it also didn't make it past the finish line.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, the decision to get rid of it was controversial with people on both sides of the issue, on both sides of the aisle. The attempt to get it back had supporters on both sides of the aisle as well. And again, clearly enough people were opposing it because it didn't happen.
Yeah. I also look at this industry and I think that the industry as it stands today by the end of the decade won't resemble anything like what it is today. In fact, I found a quote from the outgoing chairman of one of the motion picture studios, and he had predicted, this was at an investment conference. It's always interesting to look at the investor relations materials and what they say at investment conferences, because he said that Hollywood was going into about 2 years of chaos, mergers, and turmoil. And indeed, as you see right now with Warner and Paramount, that's exactly what's occurring. So I don't think states find stability with this kind of investment.
That's another thing that I think is probably worth considering too, because I think a lot of people view their economy as a poker hand.
as in, you know, like in Nevada, it's like, we've got the gaming industry and that's our strongest, our strongest card, but we really got to get some other strength. And if we can just buy this, we'll finally have a real, a strong economy that will counteract all of the problems of being concentrated in one industry. That's the same in Michigan with the auto industry. That's how people, view the economy. And one of the things that I've learned is that every state is much more diverse than its stereotype.
Yes. Yes. We've always been dependent. We were originally founded as mining and then boom and bust economy. And
I assume something, you know, in something intimately
about. A little bit. Yeah. And the state has had a goal of diversification because it's overweight on hospitality and entertainment. We've actually achieved that in the Reno area with the Tesla facility and with all the ancillary Silicon Valley businesses that have shown up there. Our rurals, because we have a lot of public land, that's really about energy and federal permitting NEPA times. And not all those rural communities want to grow, frankly. Some of them are very satisfied. And we actually have, our rurals are very well off compared to rurals in a lot of other places. Las Vegas experiences a lot of boom and bust on hospitality. Our opportunity is in logistics and distribution because of access to Pacific ports, Pacific Rim. I kept arguing that what we needed to invest in was industrial parks here because Arizona and Utah are cleaning up in this area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that, well, but, you know, no Hollywood star appears at an industrial park.
Let me put something else that is underappreciated is that the importance of the housing industry and housing construction, housing finance is part of your economy. Every place it is vital. It is necessary. It is underappreciated as an economic development tool.
It is. When the pandemic, when we came out of the crisis period of the pandemic, we had a very smart gentleman come out and speak, and he says, we should put all of our resources into housing, child and elder care, and broadband. And he says, if you take your ARPA and CARES money and you invest it in those three areas, you will create economic development and diversification. And I thought that was very smart. And we tried to do some of that when we were in government. And this administration is trying to do a lot. And I'm trying to assist the current governor's office on the housing side. It's a real challenge. The economics are difficult.
And celebrities don't come to your city when you have a thriving housing market.
No, they don't. I think that everyone expects to be able to go in a restaurant and see some movie star sitting there, when really this is just creating a pool of capital that film financiers can use to finance movies. Sony has 9,100 employees. They were saying this was going to have 19,000 people working at the studio or 17,000 people. I mean, that's just not real. That doesn't add up. And I kept asking also, if this was going to create so many jobs for Nevadans, why did the project include two large hotels? Mm-hmm. Who's going to stay there? So I like the people I met in this business. I like the people there. But, you know, this is, by definition, the motion picture and television industry, it's a California Hollywood business. That's their equivalent of your auto industry. It's our equivalent of the gaming and hospitality.
And all those film producers would be happy if the state taxpayers of Nevada pay for 25% of their expenses.
Their movies, yes. Which we would be paying more for that than we're spending on the highway patrol. I once came up with a list of agencies that we would be spending more on movies than we would on critical state agencies.
Well, that's good. And that's important, too, because these things have opportunity costs. The money that you spend on film subsidies can't be spent elsewhere. And those other things have economic multipliers, too, and provide important public services that only the government can provide. I got to ask you about something that you mentioned earlier. What is the Film Noir Society?
So if you think about the old Humphrey Bogart movies, the Detour movies, the black and white films with rain-soaked streets, you know, those kinds of movies. And the Film Noir Society is just, it's a group, a national group that has film festivals around the country where they screen these old 1940s and 1950s kind of, you know, Veronica Lake and those kinds of actors and actresses. So, yeah.
Cool.
Where do you see this issue headed in Nevada in the future now that it was razor-thin margins?
Yeah, I don't think we'll see it come back. We've got to focus on housing. I mean, this has come to three legislative sessions now. I just can't imagine that we'll see it again. And you know, these votes were pretty polarizing. I'd like to see the state come together and focus on housing, focus on industrial logistics distribution.
That's interesting, because if I was on the other side and I saw a razor-thin margin, it's like, let's run this thing again. We've got a shot next time.
My perception is that everyone's exhausted from this issue.
Mm-hmm. I guess a couple of years, hard fight. And this is like a special session that's mostly about this thing, right?
Yeah, well, the special session was called, actually, they needed to do some budget tweaks. They needed to do something because of the government shutdown to release money from our rainy day fund to help with food banks and things like that. And then this was added. I wasn't part of that decision making. And it was a crime bill there also. And at the end, there was also an attempt to deal with the corporate purchasing of houses, where you have REITs and private equity buying, you know, hundreds and thousands of homes. That measure didn't get through, but it's something I'll probably kind of turn my attention to now, try to better understand that.
Well, that is an interesting point that I think I wasn't appreciating as much, which is legislative exhaustion's a real thing. That matters.
It is.
I mean, legislators really want to pass bills that have overwhelming bipartisan support. Like, that's their top priority. And then if they have majorities or, you know, trifectas to get it without bipartisan support, they're happy doing that. But if it's a thing that they've tried multiple times, they get sick of hearing about it. They'll question whether there's a path towards victory. And so the next time, you know, a lobbyist comes to their office and says, hey, what about this? Whether it's film subsidies or another issue, they say, look, show me a path to victory and maybe I'll get behind it, but count me as a no until then.
Well, I think we also have a far better understanding that transferable tax credits don't magically transfer the tax obligation to somebody else, that they are costly, and that there's a, you know, it's a substitute, as you all pointed out, for an appropriation. It's just a backdoor appropriation. And so I think there's a better understanding of that. But the states, including your state, you know, the whole regime of federal and state funding arrangements, from Medicare to you know, formula grants to other grant programs, that's all in play right now. And these legislators, I think, in their next session are going to have to figure out what the new proportion the states are going to have to pay for Medicaid. Will we see a loss of formula grants? Will we see a loss of competitive grants? You know, and so I think that legislators are going to be very occupied between now and the end of the decade in the restructuring of the federal-state funding relationship.
Michael, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I appreciate all the fine research that you all produce.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.